I'd like to welcome you all to the 2013 Doug Wright Awards. It is our 9th annual awards ceremony. I just wanted to say a few words about the event itself. I'm not going to do that. I almost forgot to do the thing that all the nominees hate, which is off the top. I'm going to introduce all of you, and if you could cue that up, actually. There you go. So yeah, I'm going to introduce all of them, and they're all going to have to come up on stage and kind of this tiny stage, and then you'll all clap. So I'd like to introduce the nominees for the 2013 Doug Wright Awards. Nina Bunjaback. Nina has to come up on stage.
Just come.
No. We're gonna roll with it.
The alarm has been cleared.
Yes. David Collier. Michael Como. We founded the awards in 2004, following the first ever TCAF, actually. In 2005, we held our first ceremony in a Toronto bar, and we've tried a few locations on for size since then, including the AGO for a few years. But we're I'm very critical of the venues, but I'm really, really jazzed. That's a good thing about this venue. I think it's fantastic. Yeah. I'd like to thank Marriott for helping out, and it obviously has a draw, because I've never seen so many people at an awards, our awards show, so thanks for coming. For those of you who aren't aware, the name behind the awards was a man whose name was synonymous with Canadian comics for more than 30 years. Doug Wright began his cartooning career in the 1940s, and by the 50s he was drawing two of the country's most popular strips, Juniper Junction, his own creation, Nipper. Nipper turned into Doug Wright's family in the 1960s, and it is essentially a 32-year epic poem on the joys and miseries of modern family life. Doug died in 1983, But we're happy every year, 9 years in a row, to have Phyllis right there in that picture, looking as lovely as always, with Doug in the studio. And Phyllis is in the front row here with her son and daughter-in-law, and you can stand up and say hi. Phyllis. I'm not going to make too much of this, but I think it's fair to say that I feel like Phyllis is like a second mother to me, and I mean that in a good way. and I think there's a bit of a son thing going on, because we'll often email back and forth. When are the awards? What's going on? And then, oh, I haven't talked to you in a while. Sorry. Get back to you. But what I think about, well over 10 years ago, when Peter Berthelbeau and I actually showed up at your house to flip through...
In Tilsonburg.
Flip through your art. For eventually would become a book that Seth and I edited, which is back there if anybody wants to check it out. And then to our really shaky beginnings in a bar. She's supported us throughout that whole time and trusted us, more importantly, even when some of the things we came up with may have seemed a little outrageous, like an award that in the shape of a hat, maybe, or I don't know. but she's always, we've always consulted with her, and she, I think, trusting us has been really important because it is her husband's name on the awards, and we take it very seriously. Doug Wright was a classic journeyman cartoonist who works extremely hard. I don't know how he put out the amount of work he did, and I think the goal is to have him as kind of an exemplar of what a cartoonist can be in terms of putting that amount of work out and quality work, being so dedicated to his art and being so good at it and his craft. Anyways, we couldn't have done any of this without her. I'm ecstatic. We couldn't do it with her if she wasn't here tonight as well. So thank you. And I'll just get some other stuff out of the way. I want to thank our sponsor, our chief sponsor, which is the Guiling Books and Art, who's actually the sponsor of our Spotlight Award. And I also like to thank TCAF, of course, and Smiley Guy Studios, Deanna Tamblin, who's our webmaster, Rachel Ritchie, who was invaluable this year. She pulled off the PowerPoint for us, our interview series, doing Twitter and Facebook stuff for us. Ethan Rilley, who did our fantastic poster, which I think was up there, which is being sold as ridiculously cheap prints, signed and numbered prints that Ethan did. They're only $10 back there, and all that money goes to the awards. I did say they were nonprofit, right? And then Betty Liang, who's not here, designed our invitations. Peter Berkamo from Beguiling. Reese Fellicoop and Chester Brown, who immortalized our host this year. Miles Barker and Chris Butcher from TCAF, who have supported this from day one and helped us get this fantastic venue. And our nominating committee and our jury. And of course, Seth, who every year steps it up, designed the awards, designed the banners and the table covering. So I don't know what we do without him. So, and I'm just going to go real quick because this is boring at the end. Olivia Mackay, Brenda Brady, Shereen Cuthbert, Aaron Brady. Somebody's going to swell the music now and get me out. Ehab, Arifa, Jesjeet Gill, and all the artists who contributed to our fundraising auction, which is still going, actually, now. So if you go on eBay, you can actually bid on Chester Brown's interpretation of Two-Face, which is fantastic. You should check out. That ends tomorrow night, I believe. So check that out, please. And I'm going to really briefly go over tonight's event so you know what's coming. We have four categories, a Hall of Fame and three awards, which recognize comics-based work and graphic novels published in 2012. The nominating committee is made up of Brian Munn, Jerry Chikariti, Sean Rogers, Seth, and Chris Randall. And our jury this year featured Joe Ullman, Julie Delport, Pascal Girard, Jonathan Goldstein, and Natalia Janchek. So we have the Best Book Award, which recognizes the best single work or graphic novel for 2012. Then there's the Doug Wright Spotlight Award, aka the Nipper, which recognizes talent deserving of wider recognition. The winners of both of these categories receive a Doug Wright Award trophy, which was designed by Seth, which I encourage you to take a look at because they're fantastic. Maybe the best trophy in comics. I don't know. I think it is. And then there is the Pigskin Peters Award, which recognizes the best in experimental and avant-garde comics, which is the aforementioned hat. Which is, and a plaque, and a hat box, and the idea of it is to, the idea of it is supposed to be kind of an offbeat award for kind of experimental comics. And it's named after seminal comics for Bird's Eye Center by Canadian cartoonist Jimmy Fry, who's a character in the Big State Theaters. So, and all three winners will also receive a custom-bound version of their book for posterity, which you won't get tonight, because you'll get it in the mail. My fault. The fourth piece of our awards is kind of a centerpiece, the Giants of the North, which we also call the Canadian Cartoonist Hall of Fame. And this year, we're extremely pleased to induct Albert Chartier, who's a legendary Francophone cartoonist, into our Hall of Fame. And Chartier, who died in 2004, was a genuine giant of comics, writing and drawing several influential strips in a career that stretched nearly 60 years. And we've been trying to do this for a long time to get him in. He's fantastic and not really well known outside of Quebec, outside of the borders, unfortunately, because very little of his work has been translated. But I think you even need to know French in some cases to appreciate his art. It's so beautiful. And we're lucky to have Guy Badeau, the extremely popular and not legendary, I shouldn't say legendary, no? who goes under the name Badeau, B-A-D-O, who draws in La Presse, sort of
out here.
What is it? That's wrong.
That's Chapelot.
You're right. Sorry. Derdois. Anyways, I got. Sorry. Jimmy Beaulieu, who is here as well, who is a Quebec cartoonist, and he wrote a biography on Chartier, which I think will be available back there as well. So, yeah, we're going to have the Pigskin Peters Award, the Spotlight Award, the Hall of Fame portion of the award, and then wrap up with the Best Book Award. And then following the ceremonies, tonight's winners will be on hand, and we're actually right out there in the lobby, and they'll be able to sign the books, so we'll be signing them for a while. And I already mentioned, signed prints, and that's it. And I also urge you to look at the great book, and there's three Nipper books, which collect 2 years' worth of strips, designed by Seth, and I wrote a brief intro with them. All right, really, that's enough for me. I'm just going to introduce our fantastic host. Our host this year is well known to comedy fans as a member of the famed sketch troupe Kids in the Hall, which ran from 1988 to 1995 on CBC in Canada and on HBO and CBS in the United States. After the kids left television in 1995, Scott and the kids wrote and starred in one of my favorite films, Brain Candy, which is a cult favorite to this day. Speaking of another favorite of mine, Thompson also appeared as a regular on the revolutionary comedy series The Larry Sanders Show, as Brian, the long-suffering assistant to the blowhard sidekick of the show, Hank Kingsley. He continues to write and act today, and is currently starring in NBC's Hannibal, alongside Lawrence Fishburne, and Mads Mikkelsen, and Hugh Dancy. As well, he happens to be a comics fan, which is why I actually asked him. And he wrote a graphic novel called The Hollow Planet about his mustachioed alter ego, Danny Husk, which was published in 2010, and he is currently writing a sequel to that. And that book, I believe, is also in the back, so get him to sign that. I'm really tired of talking. I want to leave you in the able hands of Scott Thompson. Mr. Scott Thompson.
Not for the money. I was worried that I would be overdressed because I didn't have a tie. I'm just taking a quick scan. I don't feel so overdressed. I took this. I wanted to do this because of I've written a graphic novel. I love graphic novels. I love the genre. And I thought, first of all, I want to say something about the hotel. Do you mind, Chris, Brad? I know, we haven't closed the deal in the house yet, so I can say this. What the hell? This place, I was wandering around for 40 minutes because it's called, what is it, what's the name of the place?
Bloor Marriott Yorkville.
Bloor Marriott Yorkville. This is not Yorkville. It's not Yorkville. East of Young, it's not Yorkville. It's like, oh, I'm Upper Regent Park. No, you're from Regent Park. I'm from Lord J. Finch. You're from Jay Finch. Anyways, the I just had to.
Is it done now? Is it on?
I mean, it's Yorkville. Come on. Come on, hotel. I wanted to tell a little story before we began. And bear with me, it's actually a little, it's funny, but it's kind of, it's heartwarming. It might be heartwarming.
It's heartwarming.
It might even be a little like, it might even touch you a little bit. But I thought, this is the crowd to do it with. So I published a graphic novel, The Hollow Planet, a few years ago. And people think, why would you get into graphic novel business? I mean, comics, and of course the obvious answer is, the money. My book sold 2,000 copies, which is actually kind of a bestseller in the graphic novel world. I saw actually exactly 0 cents. Zero! I mean, I'm not even exaggerating! How could it be? But mine was a bestseller. What about the other poor schmucks who can't sell books on their name? What do they make? They must pay to get them published. But I did it, and I guess I had to do it because I, sometimes, as you people know, sometimes you have a story in you that has to get out no matter what. And it's not about the money, it's just because you have to do things. And I'm like that. Like, my subconscious comes calling, and I go, you bitch! How dare you work me like this for nothing? But she doesn't care. She just rides me and she puts me away wet. That's just the way it is. So I have no regrets about this because I have to tell the story. Now, people out there, some of the nominees, they have stories like working in a law firm or the death of a beloved family member, or even the actual creation of the universe. Those are big stories, stories that must be told. My story is about a middle-aged man who falls through a hole and ends up a sex slave at the center of the earth. Yes, that's the story that I had to tell. So, I wrote the book originally as a screenplay. I thought I would be able to get this book, this movie made. But this man falls through a hole. He gets to be a sex slave. He falls in love with a 28-foot woman. He flies around on a mammoth. There's telepathy. There's talking lizards. We're talking basically about a $300 million film. And I was naive enough to think that someone would make this $300 million picture on the backs of an obscure gay comedian from Canada. The likelihood of it ever being turned into a movie would be about the same likelihood of Michael Richards hosting the next NAACP Awards. But I kept doing it, and I kept trying to get it sold, and everyone told me no over and over and over again. So eventually I just put it away, but I would return to the story because it was a story that I had to tell. And I would return to it joyfully just to work on it. And then about 4 years ago, I started to read graphic novels, and I went, wow, my book would be an excellent graphic novel. So I started pitching it to graphic novel companies, and Frozen Pond, a company from Florida, headed by Stefan Nielsen, bit, and so we decided that we would convert this this unwieldy screenplay into a graphic novel. So we started doing that, and that was 4 years ago. Now, the exact same time that I got this deal to create this graphic novel, I was diagnosed with cancer, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So it's like, the universe is balanced. It's like, something good happens, something, we gotta take something away. So I got diagnosed with cancer, and I started my treatment, my chemotherapy and radiation. It went on for about 8-9 months. It was very difficult, but we started to create this book. I had this graphic novel that I had to do, and it kept me going all through my treatment. I would go and I would get my chemo, and I would come back and I'd vomit, and then I would start working on it again because I just wasn't. Art is what kept me going. I go, I've got to get this done. And so we were working on it online, and I would go through all the different texts that Stefan would send me from Florida, my artists from Wyoming, another letter in Newfoundland, my inker in Niagara Falls. And so we worked the whole thing online for like 9 months, and I would return to it constantly, and it would just keep me going, almost like another pillar of my treatment. And then the strangest thing happened. In the book, the character Danny Husk is a guy who loses everything in his life. He thinks that he's losing everything. And he's very proud of his mustache. It's all about his mustache. And when he becomes a sex slave at the center of the earth, naturally, the first thing you do with your slave is you take all their hair off. So Danny loses his mustache like Samson. And he thinks that he's lost his strength, his power, and that he's over. So as this is happening, as we start to work on this part of the graphic novel, my pictures start flooding in from my artist in Wyoming, Kyle Morton. And it's Danny Husk, who I am, and he has no body hair. He's got no hair, he's got no eyebrows, nothing. And at the exact same time, my hair is falling out. So as my hair is falling out, I'm looking at these pictures that are coming in of me the way I looked. And I would go, how could this happen? Like, I created this story 12 years ago. It was as if my subconscious, in a way, knew something that I didn't know and was sending me a message to the future. Like, okay, Scott, in the future, you're going to get cancer. You'll think you're going to lose everything, just like Danny. But the thing is, Danny's going to get better. You will get better. And at the end of it, when you return from this journey, as Danny returns from his journey, you will be better than ever. And not only that, your hair will be unbelievable. Look at my hair, people. I'm 53, I've got no gray hair. But my point is that I just think that art is extremely powerful, and the subconscious is unbelievable. It knows things that we don't even know. And that even if you just think it's a fantastical story, this story kept me going. It actually, in many ways, helped save my life. And I want to say to all you people out there that are writing these books, you write them because you love to write them, because you have to write them. And I think that's the wonderful thing, and I just want to salute you for what you do, because art is, for me, everything. And you do it because you have to do it. And obviously, there's no money in it, unless they turn it into a big movie. So I think the least that we can do for you tonight is to give you some awards, and or at least throw you a party. So that's my little story about how graphic novels saved my life. We'll now move on. Brad, what do I do now? Are you trying to sell a house right over there? So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to show a little film. Is there a title? What do I say about this film?
What do you want to say about it? Is there a title for it? It's the best book.
This is a
tribute,
film.
Tribute to the best
a tribute book. To the best books. Let's run it. Or not. Let's have a fire, another fire alarm. That was fun. Wasn't it?
Sound. Sorry, there was a sinking fire.
Sound is so overrated. He said, I should have signed that for it really to be funny.
That's hilarious.
This is a yearly tradition.
Does this always happen?
Come on, show me it. What do you have?
Start over.
Don't be like that. Just show me the thing.
I'm just kidding. You guys want to see this thing, huh?
Yes.
Well, I suppose I could spare a quick peek.
Sorry.
Oh, what's going on, Brad?
No, it's just...
Brad, what are you doing?
Ready?
Position this. Very dangerous position. You trust the world too much. Too much trust in people. I think you trust your host too much.
Is it working?
Yeah, he's trying to run the audio and the video at the same time. There's a problem with that. So.
Oh, audio and video at the same time. What do they think of next?
No. Come on, show me it. What do you have?
Oh, nothing.
Don't be like that. Just show me the thing.
I'm just kidding. You really want to see this thing, huh?
Yes.
Well, I suppose I could spit quick peek.
Neat. It's Scott Thompson. I love the kids in the hall. Where did you find them?
Hannibal on NBC.
Hey, can you put me down? I've got to go host the Doug Wright Awards.
It's just a baby, I'm pretty sure.
I do exfoliate every night. You know what they say, black don't crack, but white gotta fight.
Bones or something, it practically weighs nothing.
Well, I do work out every day to hyperbaric zero gravity chamber. But there's no need for flattery. You're already nominated.
What are we gonna do with them?
Are you gonna let me go before the show?
Nah.
Nah!
The hours, the days, the weeks pass by.
Three illustrations? What are the sizes? Now, look, you've got two balls.
Shocking chicken. Is that okay?
Do you feel like hearing some music?
Oh, nice coffee.
Really? Well, what can I play for you? Name your two.
Ave Maria by Schubert.
Yeah, I don't really know that one.
Verlies by Beethoven.
Sorry, that's not on my repertoire.
How about Gangsters in Paris by Jay-Z and Kanye?
You're not making this easy on me.
Just play whatever.
You can win, you may lose. I hope to God they're selling booze. You've been nominated for a Doug Wright Award. Yes, you've been nominated for a Doug Wright Award.
Styles and fashions. It is traditional that any child with royal blood be completely featureless. Only upon inheriting or marrying into a noble or aristocratic title can they be outfitted in royal garments. Each outfit is unique to its wearer and can only be removed upon death. They are waterproof. Notable royals with their outfits. Margrave Blunder.
Hello.
Queen Amelia.
Hi.
Viscount Scott Thompson.
Hello, everybody! Well, this outfit is lovely, huh? Take a look. But I was thinking of something more along the lines of a tuxedo or a nice suit. This might be a little out of place at the Doug Wright Awards. You know that you're nominated, right? Any idea what you'll wear to the show? Oh, what a beautiful dress. You'll fit right in. Actually, maybe you should check with Chester Brown to make sure he's not wearing the same thing. Last year he came in a dead mouse.
Now let's workshop some client service mind maps.
They're calling Scott into 25H. I thought you should know.
After a strong start, we feel you've lost your drive. You're telling too few jokes and you don't seem happy. You sometimes give the impression of not wanting to learn.
But gentlemen, you haven't seen the show yet.
We no longer feel you're a proper fit.
Come on. Who are you going to get? Don McKellar again? That guy's unstable.
We advise you to accept this package and clear your belongings quietly.
Would it help if I told you that you've been nominated for a Doug Wright Award?
Jennifer, get me Mark McKinney on the line.
No!
All of a sudden, I hear voices. The doors burst open and the room is flooded with guests, dozens of familiar faces.
Here, my darling daughter. Pour your mother a drink and tell her what's on your mind.
Or sing about the golden bird that summoned the future from a winter moon.
I'm here on behalf of death.
The ghosts of the animal kingdom.
The 12 seasons.
And the Doug Wright Awards! You've all been nominated! Oh. Is this a bad time? Should I come back? Why, I just thought since you were all together. Did you guys see that bear outside kicking the car? What was that all about? Okay, okay, I'm going. Well, congratulations to all the Best Book Award nominees. It's weird seeing myself drawn like that. I realized that I'm really cross-eyed. I didn't quite realize how much I looked like Karen Black from Here to Here. Okay, moving right along, we're going to do our first award. Right now, we're going to be giving the Pigskin Peters Award. I'm going to read the nominees and a little bit of a description about each person, and then we're going to give the award. So, the first nominee, I hope this is right. Is this the Hamilton Illustrated?
Yep.
Yes. Our first nominee is Hamilton Illustrated by David Collier, published by Woolsack and Wynn. Hamilton Illustrated reads like a chummy guided tour of Canada's great blue-collar metropolis. But as with all things Collier, it is too highly individualistic to ever be embraced by the Hamilton Chamber of Commerce. More a travelogue than a traditional sketchbook collection, Collier presents a street-level view of his city, the downtown primarily, choosing to ignore the homes in the mountain. Collier's beloved, polluted harbor, in which he kayaks and swims in daily, gets a starring role. These sketchbook pages are brimming over with the kind of weirdos, lost souls, and plain folk who make up Hamilton's shop-worn streets. What a nice way to talk about Hamilton's streets. Shop-worn. Yeah, that sounds a lot better than, like, dilapidated, doesn't it? Than sad. Shop-worn. Scott, you look shop-worn. No, I'm sad. No, you look really shop-worn. No, I'm tired. And yet, Ollie comes off as the most eccentric of the bunch because he cannot help but infuse every page with his freewheeling intellect and unbounded curiosity. This is a sketchbook of a man driven to a draw, explore, and engage the world. Hamilton Illustrated is pure, undiluted Collier. Second nomination is Helberga 2 and Sir Softly by Michael Como. Not Michael Comeover. He changed it. It used to be Michael Comeover. It's a little, anyways. That one, it's a French name, so it really won't even work with the French people. But believe me, in English, it's quite funny. Michael Como's Helberga 1 was an unauthorized Wolverine adventure. Oh, if it's unauthorized, I shouldn't even be talking about it. Because I might get in trouble with the studios. And I'm back on TV, and I can't fuck around now. I can't screw it up. I did it already the last time. Anyways. That Penny the Greedy Mutant against corrupt Mounties, rapacious polluters, and a tyrannical anti-pope with the former Prime Minister Stephen Harper. Helberga 2 maintains the screen-printed, pasteboard aesthetic and apocalyptic... Brad, this is wordy. And apocalyptic themes of its predecessor. But the superhero pastiche has given way to an almost wordless tour through nightmarish prairie landscapes. Wordless, unlike this description. This is not wordless. When Canada's most taciturn... unusually melancholy or shop-worn. The next nomination is Four Panel, a special feature in Carousel magazine by, oh my lord, a lot of people, Michael DeForge, Larry Eisenstein, Jesse Jacobs, Mark Ngui, and Ethan Riley. Mark, I'm sorry, I did my best. Tin Can Forest, who the hell? Oh, Tin Can Forest. That's like a dog. Is it a dog? Brad? What, you think water's going to help me? Oh, give him water. That'll shut him up. Tin Can Forest. Magda, what is with you in your last name? Oh, thank God you spelled it out phonetically for me. But not in GUI. Okay. Magda Trozowski and Mark Laliberte. The artists who contribute to Four Panel are working in a grand tradition. Whether it's a sonnet or a fugue, an experimental French novel, or a regular old peanut strip, artists have often accompanied great things while working under certain constraints. I understand. In the pages of Carousel magazine, under the editorship of Mark Laliberte, Cartoons are presented with a small and predetermined canvas, a mere 4 panels to do with as they wish. The possibilities are endless, with results ranging from the abstract to the slapstick, from the poetic to the plain bizarre. The cartooning that results from 4 panels' strict format is free, inspired, and wonderfully new. The next nomination is So, What Should We Do With Ourselves? From Wowie Zonk, number 4, and Little Stump, by Jeanette LaPomme. There's something disarming and charming about the latest comics by Jeanette LaPomme. The Toronto artist fills her candy-colored landscapes with toadstools and elfin creatures. Her ugly-looking cartoons attend a circus where little hearts and smiley faces cheer along. This seems to be a dreamy, soft, and pastel world, not cheer along. Not unlike some 1980s Saturday morning cartoon, but into this world of whimsy, LaPomme introduces malevolent spirits and impaled eyeballs. The stuff not of dreams, but of nightmares. LaPomme's characters come out of the experience all right, but change in some way. Her breezy, unsettling comics have the same effect on her readers, first entrancing us and then changing our outlook in subtle and weird ways. And the winner of the... What's it called? It's been such a long time since I said the name. My hair hasn't fallen out again, has it? And the winner of the Pink Skin Pete Award, we'll tell you what that's all about, what that means. Oh, I've got the envelope done, yeah. Right here. And the winner is... Hamilton Illustrated by David Collier.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm awfully pleased to see David win this award. I've been disappointed in previous years to see him nominated at the Doug Wright Awards, but then not walk away with the trophy. Not that the other nominees didn't deserve to win, it's just that I wanted to see David Collier recognized. I think he is an important Canadian cartoonist, and on the whole, underappreciated. David's been working for a long time now, and he's produced a rich, complicated body of work. I'm not sure there's any cartoonist in Canada who's covered so much ground, both figuratively and literally. He seems to have been everywhere in Canada and written about everything Canadian.
But not your railway trestle.
Not yet. No. His work couldn't be more about our country, yet conversely, it couldn't be more personal either. Whether writing about David Milgaard, Humphrey Osmond, Ethel Catherwood, or Grey Owl, somehow at least half the book always ends up being about Collier himself. Reading his work over the years, one gets the impression that they know Collier personally. He comes off as smart, curious, eccentric, and as a rugged individual. That said, there's always a feeling in there as well that he's making a series of ill-conceived decisions, putting himself into some kind of personal danger, barging in where he doesn't belong, opening his mouth when he should probably remain quiet. From what little I know of David personally, it seems a pretty accurate self-portrait. This isn't a Lifetime Achievement Award or anything like that. We're honoring David for one specific work, Hamilton Illustrated. And yet I can't help but extend the appreciation to his whole catalog of work. I think I've read everything he's written and found all of it thought-provoking, inspiring, funny, strange. I think my very favorite comic by David is the one he did about his grandfather, Collier's number 10, I think. One of the greatest comics ever written in Canada, so I suggest you go find it, or anywhere else for that matter. He's a dedicated artist, the kind who can't stop doing what he's doing, not just a career, but a vocation, an inborn need to express himself through cartooning. The man doesn't ever seem to stop drawing in that damn sketchbook of his either. I've seen him... I've seen him driving a car and sketching while waiting for the light to change. It didn't make me feel very safe as a passenger, but I was impressed with his sense of discipline. I wanted to take this opportunity to personally salute David Collier. Hamilton Illustrated, like all his books, is a highly individual work, and like all the best art, could not have come without someone. This is what I was talking about. Anyhow, congratulations.
Well, thank you, Chuck, and this hat will be worn. This is an experimental category worn one by an old guy, so this hat will actually be worn. And not to cover up this haircut I got last month, at Crown Barbershop in Guelph, Ontario, by Tanya. And it's quite a great barbershop. I really recommend it. It's not the log roll or anything, but it's designed by Seth. It's an amazing barbershop, and I really, really recommend it.
It was an honor to have you.
Wow, it's a great haircut, and I really appreciate it. Like Seth said, I've been nominated before, and each time I've had my faithful son and my wife sitting next to me, you know, and I thought, okay, I'd be able to wave to them from the stage if I ever finally won, you know. But tonight, James has a band competition. He plays trumpet, and he's in London, Ontario. And they started at 5:30, and Jen said they'd try to get here after. So you guys probably don't mind if we just wait until they come. I was really happy to see the fire trucks out. I thought, okay, this is really going to be delayed. Like, last year didn't start till 8, right? This whole award ceremony. Because I know, because there were all these Australian cartoonists at TCAF last year. Do you remember, anybody remember that? There's like 10 Australians.
Yeah.
There was Mandy Orton, all these. Jeep was there. You remember, I talked them into it. I said, you've got to attend the Doug Wright Awards, right? And so I took them from the reference library. And sometimes I think there's like a race to the bottom between Australians and Canadians, like who's more uncouth, right? But no, this is our chance to shine, right? As like the Doug Wright Awards. They don't have anything like this in Australia. So I thought, okay, come with me, like 10 Australians, you know, and you saw that, right? They all followed me. It was amazing. And so I thought I'd show like the best of Canada to these Australians, you know. So I took them through Philosopher's Walk and the University of Toronto. Yeah. And you weren't there, but I would have.
Come on.
There's a plaque for Innes, you know? A C.W. Jeffries plaque.
And they have a Hall of 10.
And so, I took him to a little cafe in Baldwin Avenue, near the art gallery where the awards were last year, right? You know, you know Baldwin Avenue?
The cafe, horses! How's it spelled?
It was an outdoor cafe.
Outdoor.
So this is Canada's best.
Unbelievable.
Right? Summer, right? And I'm trying to show these Australians, you know, how good.
You can't teach them anything.
No. And, so Jen and James aren't here yet. Okay, so we'll just keep going. I thought we had all kinds of time. You know, I thought, okay, the Doug Wright Awards, they start at 8 o'clock, maybe, right?
Yeah.
You know? And then, so we're waiting for our pizzas and stuff like that. It's a really fancy restaurant. So there's 10 Australians, we just...
Your shtick is becoming real!
It's really, yeah.
I thought it was shtick!
No, this is a true story!
Yeah! Now this is me. Oh, I know it's a true story!
So anyhow, you know, and like I'm saying, we're showing the best of Canada. We're so sophisticated in Baldwin Avenue. It's a bistro, right? And I went for a little walk to put up posters for my last book, Collier's Popular Press, which you know, Andy Brown published there. It's a pleasure for that. You just got to do this. And I went by the art gallery, and there's like, the Doug Wright Awards are starting at 7 o'clock, you know, and it's like 5 to 7, and the food hasn't even arrived, right? And I used to be in the military full-time. I went through basic training at Cornwallis, Nova Scotia, and we had to eat in like 5 minutes. So that's what I did to these Australians, right? I had to drop the whole, this is sophisticated Canada strip. Oh, you guys got 5 minutes to eat! Shove it in here! Let's go right now! Like, oh, like, we're not going to sitting at 7 o'clock! We don't have time for this! Come on! Oh, man! Oh, you know, Australians can really eat, you know? They shove it in the pizza! Oh! And we were like, come on! The wait staff finally we got there like 7:15, and it was like tonight. There wasn't a fire alarm, but it was just like we were sitting around. It's like getting close to 8 o'clock, and I could see like all the Australians were all like falling asleep. And they all fall and they stuck their faces so fast. And, oh. So that's, I think Canada wins as the most uncouth people. I blew it. Oh,
all right.
This is a Pigskin Peters Award, right? Yeah, if you go to Hamilton podcast, who's the guy leading the cheer?
Pigskin Pete.
1922, right. This guy has a cheer. And I'd like to teach you that Hamilton podcast cheer.
Just play along.
Yeah, yeah, okay, yeah, yeah. Maybe you can follow along. So, Oski Wee Wee!
Oski Wee Wee!
Oski Wah Wah!
Oski Wah Wah!
Holy Mackinaw!
Holy Mackinaw!
Tigers Eat a Raw!
Tigers Eat a Raw!
There we go!
That was fantastic! Good morning, ladies and gentlemen! I hope that's interesting, the story of your next book.
Maybe that's why you didn't win before!
Moving Doug right along.
Okay. Now we're going to give out another award, right?
Yep.
We're going to give out the
Spotlight Award.
Spotlight Award. And the nominees for the Spotlight Award are,
first of all, Nina Bunjevac for Heartless. Nina Bunjevac's comics are gorgeous, hilarious, and extravagantly bleak. With nimble, detailed pen work, Bunjevac conjures up sumptuous black and white pages without a hint of hopeful color. Oh, I like that. Hopeful color. In Heartless, her first book, the artist tells story after story where old world characters, lovelorn and weary, but not shopworn, get their hearts broken and hopes dashed in the stark and uncaring new world. These are the gleefully woebegone strips a bunch of acts been storing up for the past few years. And here she lets them all loose in one dramatic sigh. Whether it's a drag queen trying to kick the habit. What habit? Of being a drag queen? Or a habit?
Good question.
A nun's habit.
Yeah.
An anxious housewife trying to keep her man, or a jilted cat with an unwanted pregnancy. All of her characters suffer, but suffer beautifully. This is Nina's first Doug Wright Award nomination. The next nomination is Brandon Graham for King City, published by Image Comics. King City is an expansion of the liberated mythologies of Moebius's best work. Married to the visual fusions of Von Bode, Matt Howarth, and Masamune Shiro.
Yes!
We all know Masamune Shiro. Brandon Graham's King City has been described as pure, undiluted comics. His first major work, King City, is a reflection of his passion for the comics medium. It's also a testament to the timeless power of world building. From page one, Graham's work plunges you into a fully realized world that you never want to leave. It's a work of art you can always come home to, and every day feels like the first. It's its own new space, and with these attributes, it's like its creator, always reaching out to bring people in. The next nomination is Patrick Kyle, for Black Mass, Distance Mover, and Rowdy Song Number 4. In Black Mass, rubbery young punks discover they can hold back an insidious demonic evil by being maximally antisocial. That means assholes. This book by Patrick Kyle, who was also nominated for Distance Mover and Wowie Zonk Number 4, chronicles both the joys of drunken misbehavior and the absurdities of subcultural capital. Though the big punk off becomes ever more outlandish as the fate of the world depends on some dirtbags and their scene cred, Kyle's expressive cartooning renders the extra-dimensional mayhem with backpatch-worthy aplomb. That sentence deserves a clap. text with that sentence, I would feel so inferior. I couldn't get it up in that sentence. I would just not be able to. George Walker, The Mysterious Death of Tom Thompson. Canadian hero. A bold statement, yes. But consider, he has almost single-handedly rescued the Silent Woodcut novel from oblivion. I didn't know it needed rescuing. The Mysterious Death of Tom Thompson is his strongest work to date, and it's likely his most ambitious as well. He's told entirely in single images, one per page. His stark woodcuts guide us along a ghostly journey from his early artistic career in Toronto onward inevitably to his pitiful death in Algonquin Park. Between these two points, we experience bold drawings of war, solitude, transcendence, wonder, brutality, and mystery. The details of Thompson's death are shrouded in controversy, but he isn't squeamish about pointing fingers and crying murder. His woodcut novel asks more attention of the reader than most graphic narratives. He doesn't spoon-feed you the story. It's ironic that in this new world of digital interactive formats, one of the most demanding might be an early 20th century art form. And our last nomination is Eric Costia Williams for Hungry Bottom Pond. Surviving, curving, wavering pages of Hungry Bottom comics are the perfect way for Eric to tell his autobiographical story. Brimming over with excitement, joy, and self-discovery, Williams' autobiographical comics detail his coming of age in Toronto's queer community. I have no idea what he's talking about. No idea. I have met a Hungry Bottom or two, though. Hungry Bottoms are three. Scenes of loving feel like a party, but Williams conveys intellectual stimulation just as convincingly as he handles the physical side of things. His strip about attending an art show retains all the force of a revelation, while elsewhere he pays homage to inspirations as diverse as Beyoncé and Jean Genet, not that far apart when you really think about it. Best, though, is the bravura way that Williams breaks down his thinking about gay masculinity in a sequence that serves the book's hugely satisfying climax. No pun intended. Bringing together both its critical and sexual explorations. But lest this sound too brainy, rest assured that lots of leopard print and dancing and brawn await the curious reader too. Williams pulls out all the stops. And the winner of the Spotlight Award, right?
Yep.
Spotlight Award. What's this Nipper thing?
Nipper's like the name.
Don't you call it?
Huh?
So like the Academy Awards, like Oscar?
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly.
And the winner of the Nipper is... Nina Bumchevac for Heartless.
Choose someone because we have all good words for all the nominees, but we agreed on the importance of the art of Nina. We found it was a dark subject matter approach with a lot of humor, subtle, disturbing sometimes, sleazy. Joe just teach me that word. But also very elegant. And we appreciate the echoes of the artwork of Joe Friedman. Nina is a very accomplished artist, comics artist, for someone who only started to explore this problem recently. So,
who's 20.
Congratulations.
But thank you.
excellent publisher. I want to thank Joe Allman for recommending my work to Andy back in 2004. And thank you, Andy, for sitting on information for 8 years. Anyway, thank you, everybody. I'm really humbled. So, I don't know.
It's the Hall of Fame Award.
Right, it's in order, yeah.
And let's see, if I got everything in the right order. I don't want to give people, I don't want to give you two awards. Oh my God. I have to have you call like another fire alarm.
I forgot to thank my publisher, too.
The only way to get you off stage.
Pardon me?
He just
don't talk to him.
He's fine.
I'm hoping that he'll put me into one of his scripts. Okay. I think I've got it.
I'll ask you.
I'll get it. I'll figure it out. Don't worry. And if I'm, you'll just correct me.
Yes. Well, actually, you have some right there.
There you go.
John
has our back. Okay, but now I've got twice as many papers to fix my back. No.
I didn't do anything.
Do I introduce, this is the flowers come after?
Yeah, after.
Okay. You should have handed me that. Wax crosses first, right?
No, that's what you have to read right there, on the chair. On the chair that you threw away is what you have to read. Trust me. Hall of Fame.
I'm now pleased to introduce this year's Giants. To the Giants of the North, the Canadian Cartoonist Hall of Fame, Albert Chartier. Albert Chartier had for most of his career the dubious distinction of being the only comic strip artist making a living from his work in Quebec. Born in Montreal in 1912, he studied for 4 years at the School of Fine Arts, which he found too academic for his taste. During the Great Depression, he sketched portraits of musicians which he sold at cabaret entrances. In the late 1930s, inspired by the New Yorker, he published with his friend Marcel Tessier 14 issues of the magazine Can-Can before leaving in 1940 for New York, where he worked for the Columbia Comic Corporation and Big Top Comics. With the U.S. entering World War II, he returned to Quebec where he drew comic strips and caricatures for government publications. In 1943, he was hired by Le Bulletin des Agriculteurs to illustrate stories by Gabriel Roy. This led to his creation of his Onisim. Comic strip that would set a record in longevity by being published weekly for over 50 years. He also painted color covers for numerous French and English weeklies and monthlies, including the Montreal Star and Weekend magazine. After spending a year drawing portraits during Expo 67, he was hired by the School of Art and Commercial Crafts of Montreal, where he taught fashion and life drawing for 10 years, until reaching retirement age in 1977. Comics was a neglected art in Quebec for most of the 20th century. And it was only in 1973 that Albert Chartier would finally find recognition by having his work exhibited in Europe. In 1982, he was the star of a Quebec comic strip traveling exhibition that made its way to Albi and Toulouse. In 1990, the Montreal Comics Festival created the Albert Chartier Award to celebrate an author who has helped advance the art form, as well as the Onisim Award to celebrate the best work published that year. In 1999, he received an honorary doctorate from the University of Quebec in Hull. In 2003, Drawn and Quarterly Books devoted a section of its flagship comics anthology to an overview of his career.
including English language translations of many of his strips. He died the following year. So that's not you. You're looking good for a dead man.
Well preserved, it's like...
Very well preserved.
I got Lennon's.
Hardly shop-worn at all. But his work lives on. In part, because he's alive. Thanks to our next guest. We're pleased to have Guy Badeau. I thought so. Guy Badeau, editorial cartoonist for La Presse, and cartoonist and Chartier biographer Jimmy Beaulieu, who will discuss Chartier's life and work.
PowerPoint presentation, so you can see the work of Albert Chartier. I think it's on this
one. I'll introduce myself while they're working. First, I apologize for my English. I'm not that used to speak English, but I'll do as best as I can. And secondly, I'm here under false pretense because they told twice that I wrote a biography of Albert Chartier, and if I did, it's 2 pages long. Actually, I published a book of his mute strips, so it's a book in French, but there's about 5 or 6 pages in French, so the rest is mostly mute or bilingual, but we're going to get to that at some point. So, yes, I've published his work, but not a biography. Not yet, actually. I'd love to, but I haven't yet.
Okay. So, I have a key. I have a key somewhere. We're going to do this differently.
It's an adventure. Maybe I can entertain you some more.
Why don't you tell us about how you got in?
Okay, yeah, I'm going to do that. Thanks, Seth. I was a kid in Quebec that grew up in the country, at the Île d'Orléans, so it's near Quebec City, but it's it was very rural at that time, and the first access I had to comics was like a bit of Tintin, a bit of Asterix, and Onésime, which was in... a magazine that my grandfather received that was called the Bulletin des Agriculteurs that Chartier published in almost all his life. So to me, it was like one of the main authors of comics. I didn't see any difference in style or anything. It was like just something that I gobbled up when I was that age. And since there was only one page published at the time, I spent a lot of time on the page. Like in Tintin, I was browsing the book and reading it all over and over again, but the Chartier page, I was amazed at the movement and all that. It was I didn't intellectualize it that much as a kid, but I really appreciated the dynamics and all that. I spent hours reading those. So... as I grew up, I kind of forgot about Chartier and got interested more in avant-garde comics. And at some point, I looked back at those and thought that the cutting edge, like the work of Michel Arbaglietti or Seth and Dupuis Berberian and all the illustrators and the New Yorker and all that I loved, it all stem from the same pool in which Chartier had come to life. So at this was at the end of the 90s, and I was beginning to work in comics. It's pretty strange. I'm just gonna keep on. I was beginning to work in comics after selling comics for several years. I started, Do you want to make a carry on? I'm just going to end the chapter, and then you're going to take it over. So I was selling books, but there was no Chartier books. And the first time I've met the guys from Napastic, the first question I asked them when they said that they had a project of publishing comics was, are you going to publish Chartier at last? And I ended up helping them, driving them around, and I was kind of in the family. And the first thing I wanted to do was contact Chartier, so I met him at the festival, and we ended up at his home a little after, and maybe I can talk to this visit afterwards. Maybe you can start your thing, and we can catch up on where was it.
Okay, so I'll do an overview of his work. So Onezim obviously is the model, is the famous comic strip that ran for more than 50 years in Koyidi. Le Bulletin de, so the Bulletin de Agriculture was a paid subscription. People, farmers, would get this this magazine. So I read the wonderful, on my way on the train to Toronto, I read the wonderful Drawn in Quarterly article that was written about Chartier, and I learned a lot. I should have probably have read it before. But anyways, he explained at length the problem that facing cartoonists in Quebec at the time. The problem with Chartier's work not being recognized was that, so we see his two characters here, was that it was sold, it was, how do you say, by subscription, so therefore it wasn't in newsstand, so it didn't have the reach that it could have had, and obviously it never got to France. So this is a problem that we faced as cartoonists in the 70s. We received all the cartoons from France. We received Spirou, we received Tintin magazine, we received Pilote. So I don't know if you know Pilote, but Pilote magazine was where Gilles started, you know.
Moebius.
Later he became known, wrote, signed under the... So in the early 70s, it was fantastic what we could read. You know, we had Blueberry, you had Druyem, so, and then they went along to create Heavy Metal. So it was very difficult for us to compete against the French magazines, because what would happen was that they would print their magazine in France, and the unsold copies were sent by boat to Quebec, and so we received all these magazines like a month or 2 months later. Then they would sell these magazines in Quebec, and the unsold copies would be sent by boat to Haiti, where the unsold copies were sent back to Senegal and then to the Congo, and I guess eventually there was no returns for the magazines. So it was very difficult for us to fight against that, because they were printed in color and sold a complete run. So eventually we started an association, and Chartier was kind enough to attend our press conferences, because he gave it a bit of gravitas, you know. He said, here's at last somebody who makes a living. Well, he was known in Quebec as, you know, a comic strip artist. So I would like to take the opportunity of this presentation tonight to thank Albert Chartier, to bring the spotlight to our nascent industry in Quebec, because all we were doing at the time was publishing fanzines that sold probably 100 issues, you know, if that, because we gave away a lot. And Réal Godbout and Pierre Fournier started the Association of Comics, and Pierre Huet also created the Festival of Comic Strip at the University of Montreal, brought in all the big names from Europe,
And Montreal, it's very, you know, we were lucky in Montreal to be at the corner of two different comic cultures. We had the French comics, Franquin, Hergé, and we had magazine, Harvey Kurtzman, and all the rest. So we had two different cultures side by side. And I think that's why Montreal has generated a lot of, you know, important publishers. I'm thinking of Drawn and Quarterly, Les 400 Coups, La Pastèque, and finally we have... and it's a shame that Chartier, during his life, was not published as well as Jimmy did a wonderful book of his silence, because Chartier wanted to... He had gone to New York and wanted to, you know, reach outside of Quebec. So I'll show a few cartoons that show his... so this was translated, I think, in...
So I added subtitles. There's one thing to say is that when he went to New York, he learned to master his art, but just a cute anecdote is what he eloped with his wife. They got married without telling the family and escaped to New York, and there he showed his work around to find work. So it was just like a personal anecdote.
Okay, so this is, I kind of find this funny. So a lot of his comic strip were, you know, wordless cartoons. And the style, well, it's a bit, well, dated, but it's, I find it very elegant line, you know. Cornelius. So this is all in the book, and Brunette. Kiki was another attempt at selling wordless strips in the U.S. Another Kiki is the Doug Shaw. As in also, this is just to show you on all the lines, to show an example of something he did. I think this was done in the 70s, wasn't it?
About 68, just the hippie times and Vietnam War and all that, all the protests.
Yes. I think. Squeaking by. This was done, I think, in the Montreal Star, Weekend Magazine, in the 60s, early 60s.
Well, the nice thing about those mule strips, if I can interject a little more, is I don't think they're dated. I think they're thoroughly modern, in a way. You said it, it's very elegant. But what I like is the way it shows how the people lived in those times, in the 60s. And it's not affected. It's not like some movies we see where it's recreate the times. It's very affected, very purposeful. This is very natural. We see how would they dress to go to the opera, how they dress to go to ski, and or to take the plane. And it's very moving to see all that. There's a bit of Montreal in the background where we see the subway getting constructed, the Expo 67, and all the events of the time. But that's not... the abstract part of the strips are the most interesting aspect to me, as well as the tenderness and fun and humor in the strips. Like, it's always like a woman, but it's like an old way of seeing woman, but it's very tender. There's nothing sexist or misogynistic about it. And it's a kind of a strange balance that we don't find that often. But this book, those mood strips really contain this.
This, unfortunately, isn't translated because I couldn't scan the... in Drawn and Quarterly, they were relettered in English. Just to show you a few examples of Onisim full-page panel. This is the cover of Jimmy's... it's the cartoon that was used on the cover of Petite Brunette, which is a collection of all his wordless cartoons. A monography of... and some, a few gag cartoons.
Yeah. If we only have 5 minutes left, so maybe I can tell about he's really fondly remembered by.
read what it says at the bottom.
I don't.
The caption is, "Whoops, sorry, I thought you were my husband."
Yeah, so you said earlier that Chartier had a gravitas. He really presented himself as a grand prince, or he was really operatic about himself, and really humble in a way. It was a real paradox. Like he met Osamu Tezuka one night at the Japanese embassy in the 80s, and he was very intimidated, very nervous, so he drank a few beers, and he really didn't like the real protocol, but the atmosphere of the evening started very strict and all that with the Japanese officials, but his way of not knowing how to use the sticks and all that, it took like a half an hour to until everyone started laughing. It was that kind of personality. Like, you couldn't keep on your mask with him. When I went to his place, he was invited in us to go to Pedalo. Comment dirais-tu Pedalo? That thing where a plastic boat where we invited us to go to that with him. And he was really, really open, really, really warm, and like he's very fondly remembered by everyone. But he was quite a great character, really.
So I end with two covers that were done in, I think it's probably the charity ball. So you have a few beggars, you know, who take. And the last one is the hockey game. He's listening to the hockey game while they're at the opera.
Yeah, you always see that the tension between bourgeoisie and the popular, and there's not really. You see there's an envy from him of all the elegance and the luxury, but he plays that game with a tongue in cheek. He really stays the rough street kid from Montreal. Like he talked about the country most of his life, but he moved to the country only at 39. So there's a really urban quality to him that we don't know that much of, that I wanted to spotlight with those mule strips that song.
So I think this was probably drawn when the Canadians were a winning team. I'm from Ottawa. Now.
Wow, yeah. Thank you. Thanks. Thank you very much. That was wonderful.
I have to give a this.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Sorry about that. So this is the
I'm not here.
Sorry, he's accepting on behalf of Abar Sharche's family. So. What you've all been waiting for. Mackay.
Whatever you want. Whatever you want.
Seth or Seth, right
on Seth. Brad Mackay and Seth.
We present Guy Badeau with the Giants.
We just did that.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't get to introduce that you were going to do that.
It's all right.
That's
so keep going. Keep rolling. It's all right.
So we all just watched that.
Yeah.
It went okay. There it goes. And now the finalists for the 2013 Doug Wright Award for Best Book. First one, Michael DeForge, published by Koyama Press. The first issue of Lose arrived in 2009 on Canada's comic scene like a meteor to Earth.
unexpected and beautiful to behold. And each of the following three issues has confirmed Michael DeForge's blazing talent. And Lou's number four is no exception. A stunning single artist anthology comprised of a variety of DeForge's patented otherworldly experimental fiction. In this issue, DeForge continues to explore his fixations with transformational body imagery in altered states. The stories never fail to disturb, and at times are genuinely frightening, yet DeForge has the power to charm as well. His funny and absurd short story, Canadian Royalty, Their Lifestyles and Fashions, is an imaginary history of Canada's royal family and their highly complex ritualized traditions. Lou's number four runs the gamut from creepy to funny to queasy to beautiful, and winds back up at creepy. But there is no moment that is not daringly original. This is his fifth Write Award nomination. He won the Best Emerging Talent Trophy in 2010 and the Pigskin Peters Award in 2011. The next nomination is Jesse Jenkins, also published by Koyama Press. Jesse Jenkins' powerful mind-altering book deploys robust cartooning, abstract symbols, and surreal humor to explore the origins of life and the universe. In the London, Ontario cartoonist's eyes, all life is imagined as an elaborate art contest between bickering gods whose creations eventually take on a life of their own, for better or for worse, for good or for evil. Part creation myth, part biblical interpretation, by this shall you know him, lures you in with its loopy cartooning, then knocks you out with its heavy meaning. This is Jess Jacobs' fourth Doug Wright Award nomination. The next nomination is Le Chanson de Roland by Michel Rabagliati, published by Conundrum Press. Michelle's series of semi-autobiographical Paul graphic novels, The Song of Roland, is a stone-cold tearjerker, a tribute to his extended Quebecois family. The book switches things up a bit, focusing on the life and death of Paul's kind-hearted father-in-law, Roland, rather than Paul himself. Rabagliati uses the opportunity to take us through a masterclass in lean, clair cartooning and the epiphanies and heartbreak of everyday life. But he takes some narrative and cartooning chances here as well, stretching his creative wings a bit more than in the past. The result is familiar, but unnerving. A perfect way to rope you into his difficult tale. You won't be able to help yourself when the tears start to flow. This is Michel's third nomination. He was nominated for Best Book in 2009, 2006, and he won the trophy in 2006. Our next nomination is Pope Hat, number three by Ethan Riley, published by Ann House Books. In the latest installment of his masterful slice of life serial, Ethan Riley chronicles the lives of Frances and Vicky, two young women at the crossroads of their lives, tugged by the competing claims of work, love, and artistic expression. Riley has the ability not only to make his, unless it's really, has the ability to not only make his characters real, but also to tease out the genuine angst that comes with making life-changing decisions. The authenticity of Riley's primarily female world is made more substantial by his superb feel for urban life, complete with looming office buildings and homey tree-lined neighborhoods. Exquisitely sensitive to emotional nuance and drawn with confidence, this is a comic that could be proudly shelved next to Dan Close, Gilbert, and Jaime Hernandez and Adrian Tomei. This is his third nomination. He won the Spotlight Award in 2012. And our final nomination for Book of the Year is Wax Cross by Tin Can Forest. Published by Koyama Press. The art-making duo of Pax Shuchuk and Merrick Kolek, also known as Tin Can Forest, alternately frighten and enrapture us as they weave a dense forestry tapestry of myth, fairy tale, and ecological fable in this haunting tale of forest spirits, devils, ghosts, and apocalyptic technology. Beautiful and unsettling, Wax Cross arises from Eastern European folklore, but refuses to be pinned down. Surreal, strange, and sanguine, it is a fine addition to their stunning comics canon. This is their second nomination. They were previously nominated for Best Emerging Talent in 2011. And the winner is
The Song of Roland by Michelle.
Member and winner of the 2007 Best Book Award to the stage to deliver an appreciation of the winning work. Are you Joe? Oh, I'm Michelle. You're, that's you. Here you go.
Hello, everybody. I just want to say two quick things first, and then I'm going to speak about Michelle's book. First, being on a jury is horrible. There was aspects of every one of these books that we loved, and I feel horrible that everybody didn't win, and I'll talk about that more later. But anyway, I just want to say that first. Secondly, I'm proud of my good friend and my publisher, Andy Brown, for two of his books winning tonight. I'm really proud of him. And then, now, I just want to speak about The Song of Roland. This is the sixth book in the semi-autobiographical series, and the first to not have the character Paul's name in the title, which is appropriate, as this is the story of Paul's father-in-law, Roland Beaulieu. The story of his life and the story of his death, it is as much about this tough, self-made man as it is about the identity and spirit of Quebec itself. The book is a mid-career masterpiece from a master cartoonist at the height of his skills. And that's a sentence that gets trotted out a lot at the Comic Awards, but this book deserves it. The Song of Roland brims with classic clean-line cartooning, capturing incidental moments of the slow disintegration of a terminally ill patient, interwoven with his life story and the effects of his life and death on his family. It's poignant, well-observed, and balanced with a great deal of humor. I laughed, I cried. Seriously, I did. During the deliberation process, it became clear that Michel Rivagliati's Song of Roland had made an impression on the jurors. In fact, 4 out of 5 of us admitted to crying while reading the conclusion of this story that builds quietly and then hits with a great emotional punch. And I won't name the 5th emotionless robotic juror. The competition in the best book category this year, it was very stiff, and there were so many beautiful books by so many talented people, and we'd love to give them all a trophy, but the way that Seth designed it, they cost like $1 million. So only one book can win, and I'm pleased that the award went to The Song of Roland. It's a big book addressing big human themes with sincerity and without resorting to manipulating the audience's emotions, and refreshingly without irony. And its many moments of illustrated silence allow the reader time to reflect. And anyone who has loved someone and lost them will know that this book rings very true. Congratulations, Michelle. Yes.
It's a great honor. I just want to thank everybody. I want to thank Andy, first of all, for still believing in my work and by continue publishing me in English. I want to thank Elga Dasher, my wonderful translator in Montreal, and all the people at the TCAF and Seth for your marvelous trophy here. Thank you very much. And that's all. I wish you... Oh, and I want to congratulate the other nominees for tonight. So have a good evening. Thank you.
Sorry, I often forget this, but I didn't want it today, so. At least for you.
Okay, well, that's it. I hope everybody's enjoyed themselves. Let's give it a hand for all the nominees tonight.
A lot of those books are I just bought actually the Leona Sen book. It's beautiful. And as well, you know what the winners look like and the nominees look like now, so we'll be milling around for a bit. So if you want to buy a book, get them signed. It's great. And this is a fantastic audience. I want to thank you. And I'll see you here next year for the decade. 10 years. Okay.